The last backbenchers in the procession disappeared into the house. The mounted escort and empty carriages trotted away, and the crowds began to break up. The demonstration was over. "Are you coming, Tara?" Molly called. But Tara shook her head. "I have to meet Shasa," she said. "See you on Friday afternoon." Tara slipped the wide black sash off over her head, folded it, and placed it in her handbag as she threaded her way through the dispersing crowd. She crossed the road. She saw no irony in now presenting her parliamentary pass to the doorman at the visitor's entrance and entering the institution against whose actions she had been so vigorously protesting. She climbed the side staircase and looked into the visitor's gallery. It was packed with wives and important guests, and she looked over their heads down into the panelled chamber to the rows of sombre-suited members on their green leather-covered benches, all involved in the impressive ritual of Parliament. However, she knew that the speeches would be trivial, platitudinous, and boring to the point of pain, and she had been standing in the street since early morning. She needed to visit the ladies' room as a matter of extreme urgency. She smiled at the usher and withdrew surreptitiously, then turned and hurried away down the wide panelled corridor. When she had finished in the ladies' room, she headed for her father's office, which she used as her own. As she turned the corner, she almost collided with a man coming in the opposite direction. She checked, only just in time, and saw that he was a tall black man dressed in the uniform of a parliamentary servant. She would have passed on with a nod and a smile, when it occurred to her that a servant should not have been in this section of the building during the time when the House was in session, for the offices of the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition were at the end of the corridor. Then again, although the servant carried a mop and pail, there was something about him that was neither menial nor servile, and she looked sharply at his face. She felt an electric tingle of recognition. It had been many years, but she could never forget that face. The features of an Egyptian pharaoh, noble and fierce, the dark eyes alive with intelligence. He was still one of the finest-looking men she had ever seen, and she remembered his voice, deep and thrilling, so that the memory of it made her shiver slightly. She even remembered his words. "There is a generation whose teeth are as swords to devour the poor from the earth." It was this man who had given her the first glimmer of understanding as to what it was like to be born black in South Africa. Her true commitment dated from that distant meeting. This man had changed her life with a few words. She stopped, blocking his path, and tried to find some way to convey her feelings to him. But her throat had closed, and she found she was trembling from the shock. The instant he knew he had been recognized, he changed like a leopard coming on guard as it becomes aware of the hunters. Tara sensed she was in danger, for a sense of African cruelty invested him. But she was unafraid. "I am a friend," she said softly, and stood aside to let him pass. "Our cause is the same." He did not move for a moment, but stared at her. She knew that he would never forget her again. His scrutiny seemed to set her skin on fire, and then he nodded. "I know you," he acknowledged, and once again his voice made her shiver, deep and melodious, filled with the rhythm and cadence of Africa. "We will meet again." Then he passed on and, without a backward glance, disappeared around the corner of the panelled corridor. She stood staring after him, and her heart was pounding, her breath burned the back of her throat. "Moses Gama," she whispered his name aloud, "Messiah and warrior of Africa." Then she paused and shook her head. "What are you doing here in this of all places?" The possibilities intrigued and stirred her, for now she knew with a deep instinct that the crusade was afoot, and she longed to be part of it. She wanted to do more than merely stand on a street corner with a black sash draped over her shoulder. She knew Moses Gama had only to crook his finger and she would follow him. She and 10 million others. "We will meet again," he had promised. And she believed him. Light with joy, she went on down the passageway. She had her own key to her father's office, and as she fitted it to the lock, Her eyes were on a level with the brass plate. Colonel Blaine Malcolm S., deputy leader of the opposition. With surprise, she found that the lock was already opened, and she pushed the door wide and went in. Santan Courtney Malcolm S. turned from the window beyond the desk to confront her. "I have been waiting for you, young lady." Santan's French accent was an affectation that annoyed Tara. She had been back to France just once in 35 years, she thought, and lifted her chin defiantly. "Don't toss your head at me, Tara chérie," Santan went on. "When you act like a child, you must expect to be treated as a child." "No, Mater, you were wrong. I do not expect you to treat me as a child, not now or ever. I am a married woman of 33 years of age, the mother of 4 children, and the mistress of my own establishment." Santan sighed. "All right," she nodded. "My concern made me ill-mannered, and I apologize. Let's not make this discussion any more difficult for each other than it already is. I was not aware that we needed to discuss anything." "Sit down, Tara," Santan ordered. And Tara obeyed instinctively, and then was annoyed with herself for doing so. Santan took her father's chair behind the desk, and Tara resented that also. It was Daddy's chair, and this woman had no right to it. "You have just told me that you are a wife with 4 children. Santan spoke quietly. "Would you not agree that you have a duty?" "My children are well cared for," Tara flared at her. "You cannot accuse me of that." "And what about your husband and your marriage?" "What about Chasa?" Tara was immediately defensive. "You tell me," Santan invited. "It's none of your business." "Oh, but it is," Santan contradicted her. "I have devoted my entire life to Chasa. I plan for him to be one of the leaders of this nation." She paused, and a dreamy glaze covered her eyes for a moment, and she seemed to squint slightly. Tara had noticed that expression before, whenever Santan was in deep thought, and now she wanted to break in upon it as brutally as she could. "That's impossible, and you know it." Santan's eyes snapped back into focus, and she glared at Tara. "Nothing is impossible. Not for me, not for us." "Oh, yes, it is," Tara gloated. "You know as well as I do that the Nationalists have gerrymandered the electorate, and they have even loaded the Senate with their own appointees. They are in power forever. Never again will anyone who is not one of them, an Afrikaner nationalist, ever be this country's leader, not until the revolution, and when that is over, the leader will be a black man." Tara broke off and thought for an instant of Moses Gama. "You are naive," Santan snapped. "You do not understand these things. You talk of revolution. It's so childish and irresponsible." "Have it your own way, Mater." "But deep down you know it so. Your darling Chasa will never fulfill your dream. Even he is beginning to sense the futility of being in opposition forever. He is losing interest in the impossible. I wouldn't be surprised if he decides not to contest the next election, gives up the political aspirations that you have foisted on him, and simply goes off to make himself another £1 trillion. "No," Santan shook her head. "He won't give up. He is a fighter, like I am." "He'll never be even a cabinet minister, let alone prime minister," Tara stated flatly. "If you believe that, then you are no wife for my son," Santan said. "You said it," Tara said softly. "You said it, not me." "Oh, Tara, my dear, I am sorry." Santan reached across the desk, but it was too broad for her to touch Tara's hand. "Forgive me. I lost my temper. All this is so desperately important to me. I feel it so deeply, but I did not mean to antagonize you. I want only to help you. I am so worried about you and Chasa. I want to help, Tara. Won't you let me help you?" "I don't see that we need help," Tara lied sweetly. "Chasa and I are perfectly happy. We have 4 lovely children. Santan made an impatient gesture. "Tara, you and I haven't always seen eye to eye, but I am your friend, truly I am. I want the best for you and Chasa and the little ones. Won't you let me help you?" "How, Mater? By giving us money? You have already given us 10 or 20 million. Or is it £30 million? I lose track sometimes. Won't you let me share my experience with you? Won't you listen to my advice? Oh, yes, Mater, I'll listen. I don't promise to take it, but I'll listen to it. Firstly, Tara, dear, you must give up these crazy left-wing activities. You bring the whole family into disrepute. You make a spectacle of yourself, and therefore of us, by dressing up and standing on street corners. Apart from that, it is positively dangerous. The Suppression of Communism Act is now law. You could be declared a communist and placed under a banning order. Just consider that. You would become a non-person, deprived of all human rights and dignity. Then there is Schaas's political career. What you do reflects on him. Mater, I promised to listen, Tara said sternly, but now I withdraw that promise. I know what I am doing. She stood up and moved to the door, where she paused and looked back. Did you ever think, Santon Courtney Malcolmes, that my mother died of a broken heart? And it was your blatant adultery with my father that broke it for her? You can sit there smugly and advise me how to conduct my life, so as not to disgrace you and your precious son. She went out and closed the heavy teak door softly behind her. Schaas Courtney lolled on the opposition front bench, with his hands pushed deeply into his pockets, his legs thrust out and crossed at the ankles, listened intently to the Minister of Police outlining the legislation which he intended bringing before the House during the current session. The Minister of Police was the youngest member of Cabinet, a man of approximately the same age as Schaas, which was extraordinary. The Afrikaner revered age and mistrusted the inexperience and impetuosity of youth. The average age of the other members of the Nationalist Cabinet could not be less than 65 years, Schaas reflected. And yet here was Manfred Delarey standing before them, a mere stripling of less than 40 years, setting out the general contents of the Criminal Law Amendment Bill, which he would be proposing and shepherding through its various stages. He is asking for the right to declare a state of emergency which will put the police above the law without appeal to the courts, Blaine Malcolmes grunted beside him. And Schaas nodded, without looking at his father-in-law. Instead, he was watching the man across the floor. Manfred Delarey was speaking in Afrikaans, as he usually did. His English was heavily accented and laboured, and he spoke it unwillingly, making only the barest gesture towards the bilingualism of the house. On the other hand, when speaking in his mother tongue, he was eloquent and persuasive. His oratorial attitudes and devices were so skilled as to seem entirely natural, and more than once he raised a chuckle of exasperated admiration from the opposition benches, and a chorus of "Oor, oor!" from his own party. "The fellow has a damned cheek," Blaine Malcolmes shook his head. "He's asking for the right to suspend the rule of law and impose a police state at the whim of the ruling party. We'll have to fight that tooth and nail." "My word," Schaas agreed mildly, but he found himself envying the other man, and yet mysteriously drawn to him. It was strange how their two destinies seemed to be inexorably linked. He had first met Manfred Delarey 20 years ago, and for no apparent reason the two of them had flown at each other on the spot like young gamecocks and fought a bloody bout of fisticuffs. Schaas grimaced at the way it had ended. The drubbing he had received still rankled, even after all that time. Since then their paths had crossed and recrossed. In 1936, they had both been on the national team and had gone to Adolf Hitler's Olympic Games in Berlin. But it had been Manfred Delarey, in the boxing ring, who collected the only gold medal the team had won, while Schaas returned empty-handed. They had hotly and acrimoniously contested the same seat in the 1948 elections that had seen the National Party come sweeping to power. And again, it was Manfred Delarey who had won the seat and taken his place in Parliament, while Schaas had to wait for a by-election in a safe United Party constituency to secure his own place on the opposition benches from which to confront his rival once again. Now Manfred was a minister, a position that Schaas coveted with all his heart. And with his undoubted brilliance and oratorical skills, together with growing political acumen and a solid power base within the party, Manfred Delarey's future must be unbounded. Envy, admiration, and furious antagonism. That was what Shasa Courtney felt as he listened to the man across the floor from him. And he studied him intently.